This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Hey, I'm Lisa Loving. I'm the PM, KBOO PM News Director. Tonight we're starting a process of tinkering with our evening news broadcast. We're running free speech radio news in its entirety, followed by the locally produced KBOO Evening News. We'd like to know what you think about the broadcast. Please email me at pmnews@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 203. Also, we'd like to encourage more listeners with story ideas, especially from areas outside Portland. Later this week, we'll be setting up a story tip line. Please stay tuned for that change as well. Change is a process. Listen and get back to me. Do you like it? Do you hate it? Let me know at pmnews@kboo.org or 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thanks and stay tuned.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, January the 9th, 2006. From WPFW in Washington, D.C., I am Selena Masuda, sitting in for Auda Bogado. Columbus, Ohio's African and Black communities demand police accountability for a Somali youth's death. Hong Kong activists call for a dismissal of charges against WTO protesters, and violence continues to escalate in southern Iraq. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Republican Congressman Tom DeLay will leave his position as House Majority Leader. Ingrid Drake reports from Washington, D.C.
In the midst of federal investigations into lawbreaking and ethics violations of lobbyist Jack Abramoff and several Congress members and their staff, Speaker of the House J. Hennis Hastert announced yesterday he will, quote, move forward aggressively and quickly to address lobbying reform. Mary Boyle with Common Cause, a D.C.-based citizens lobbying group.
We are seeing a lot of reform proposals right now come out of Congress, and when Congress gets back in town, we will be seeing even more. One of our main concerns is there has been no enforcement at all of rules that do exist. Certainly we have some very, very serious and substantive reform proposals, but we also need to start enforcing the rules that are out there.
The election of a new House Majority Leader is scheduled for the week of January 30th. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake.
The fatal shooting of an undocumented Mexican teenager by a Border Patrol officer along the San Diego-Tijuana border has outraged Mexican authorities, adding more tension to the complicated immigration debate between both countries. Luis Perez reports from Tijuana.
Guillermo Martinez was shot in the back on Friday, December 30th, while attempting to enter illegally into the U.S. After being shot, Martinez ran back to Mexico, where he died hours later in a local hospital. The incident was promptly condemned by Mexican federal authorities, as well as civil leaders and human rights defenders on both sides of the border. The fatal shooting comes at a particularly tense moment between Mexico and the United States after the U.S. House passed an immigration measure to extend and fortify the metal fence along the common border. Investigations into the shooting are underway by Mexican and U.S. authorities. The results are due in 30 days. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Luis Perez in Tijuana.
A study conducted by Indian and Canadian researchers has concluded that millions of abortions based on the gender of the fetus have caused a lopsided female-to-male ratio in India. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
The British medical journal The Lancet reports that an estimated 10 million female births have been selectively aborted in the last 20 years. The Indian society has been traditionally male-dominated, and many families consider girls as a liability, especially when they are to be married off with a huge dowry. The research found that educated classes have the tendency to selectively abort females when previous children had been girls. Though sex determination and sex-selective abortions are illegal in India, the business in this sector, all equipped with the latest technology, has been widespread in major cities. Female births have been on the decline in the past decade. Today, the ratio stands at 933 females for every 1,000 males. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
A particularly harsh winter is adding to the miseries of the survivors of the October 8th earthquake in Kashmir. Shanawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
Temperatures have dropped below freezing in Kashmir, and most of the quake survivors in Indian-administered Kashmir are living in tin sheds, highly inadequate for the harsh winters. It has been one of the chilliest winters in decades. Aid workers in the region are reporting a lack of fuels like firewood necessary to keep warm in the harsh winters. Heavy snowfall in the last week has left some villages inaccessible, creating shortages of food and essential supplies. The Voluntary Association Network, a local organization working in the relief efforts, has warned of higher casualties in the absence of heating arrangements. The United States military has doubled cargo loads on its helicopters to the remote affected areas in Pakistan-administered Kashmir to ensure adequate supplies in the region before snows pile higher. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
Another toxic spill has polluted a major waterway in China, and a capsized boat full of chemicals could potentially cause further problems. Dante Tosa reports from Hong Kong.
Sunday morning, a boat containing hundreds of tons of sulfuric acid sank and capsized at the bottom of the Yangtze River, the longest-running river in Asia. According to the official press reports, the sunken cargo boat contained at least 260 tons of sulfuric acid. This would be the fourth major chemical accident to affect a Chinese river in the last 3 months. Last week, Xiangjiang River was polluted by an industrial cadmium spill. According to the state-run Xinhua News Agency, at the height of the spill, cadmium level was at 25.6 times greater than the safety standard. Cadmium is carcinogenic and is extremely toxic even in low concentrations. Media report indicates that water will probably not be shut off along the route of the cadmium spill. As for the sunken boat containing hundreds of tons of sulfuric acid, there have not been any reports of the recovery of the boat by either of the official news agencies. From Hong Kong, this is Dante Tosa for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee opens its confirmation hearing for Judge Samuel Alito to be U.S. Supreme Court Justice. If confirmed, Alito would replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. As Justice O'Connor is regarded as a moderate conservative and swing vote on the court, many believe Alito will go through a much more contentious confirmation battle than Chief Justice John Roberts did several months ago. Jan May is in the hearing room at Capitol Hill.
Committee Chairman Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter says Chief Justice John Roberts has pledged allegiance to the judicial principle of modesty and stability, and it's unlikely he will change the direction of the Supreme Court. Therefore, Alito will not be a critical swing vote if he's confirmed. In a 1985 memo, Alito stated, "The Constitution does not provide a right to an abortion." Specter says Alito has to explain how his personal belief will impact his judicial decisions.
This hearing will give Judge Alito the public forum to address the issue, as he has with senators in private meetings, that his personal views and prior advocacy will not determine his judicial decision, but instead he will weigh factors such as stare decisis, that is, what are the precedents, that he will weigh women's and men's too reliance on Roe, and he will consider too whether Roe is, quote, embedded in the culture of our nation.
Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy is the most powerful Democrat on the committee. He says Alito has to demonstrate his ability to maintain judicial independence at a time of inflated presidential power.
The president has, outside the law, been conducting secret and warrantless spying on Americans for more than 4 years. This is a time when the protections of Americans' liberties are directly at risk, as are the checks and balances that have served to constrain abuses of power for more than 200 years. The Supreme Court's relied upon by all of us to protect our fundamental rights.
Alito argued in 1984, an executive branch official who authorized the illegal wiretapping of U.S. citizens without a warrant should be immune from lawsuits. Senator Edward Kennedy, a Democrat of Massachusetts, was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee when Alito was confirmed to be a judge on the Third Court of Appeals. Kennedy says Alito voted to be an impartial judge during the hearing, but his judicial record has been troubling.
In a study by the well-respected expert Professor Cass Sunstein of the University of Chicago Law School, Judge Alito was found to rule against the individual in 84% of his dissents. To put it plainly, average Americans have had a hard time getting a fair shake in his courtroom.
Following Kennedy's scathing comments, Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley gives an embracing remark.
From all accounts, Judge Alito has an impressive and extensive legal and judicial record, certainly one worthy of someone on the Supreme Court.
Republicans remind Alito that he does not have to be forthcoming. Democrats demand Alito to answer questions fully and honestly. Most senators declare they remain open-minded until the confirmation hearing concludes. But a block away from the hearing room, in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, demonstrators have already made verdicts on Alito. Most contention surrounds the issue of abortion rights. People from both pro-choice and pro-life camps are eager to prove their own beliefs the truth and the opposition dead and wrong.
3,500 babies that are slaughtered every day in the United States. Is
not
that okay
babies,
with you?
They're fetuses, they're potential babies.
No,
they're
fetuses,
not human beings.
Little ones, to be getting everything for that baby.
The confirmation hearing will last through the entire week. Tomorrow morning, senators will start the first round of questions. The Senate will vote on the nominee on January the 20th. I'm Ye Meixie at Capitol Hill.
After a week of escalating violence in Iraq, the conditions in the south of the country continue to deteriorate, with almost 500 Iraqis either dead or injured. The lack of infrastructure and reconstruction is taking its toll in the region, which has previously showed progress and has been cited as an area without high security problems. FSRN's Salam Talib spoke to Iraqi activist Iman Ahamash about the situation in the south.
Now, in the south, where the situation is supposed to be safe, I mean, the security is supposed to be established and etc., there is no resistance, there are no terrorists, as they call them, but the situation is even worse. I was in Basra. I spent almost a week in Basra, and Basra is simply has become a dumping, you know, garbage dumping place.
Meanwhile, the city of Nasiriyah, 380 kilometers south of Baghdad, has been closed for the third day after demonstrations by the city's unemployed. Demanding economic relief, the protesters were attacked and shot by the Iraqi military and Iraqi police, wounding many and killing 21. Today, the police announced that security arrangements in the city have been put on high alert. The head of the security forces, Abdul Amir Manati, said that they were not responding to locals. He said that the violence is a result of strangers that have arrived in the city. But Abdul Sattar al-Azawi, a journalist in Nasiriyah, spoke with FSRN about the demonstration.
In Nasiriyah, there were protests on
the people of Nasiriyah have been making demonstrations because of the high percentage of unemployment. And this is caused by corruption in the city's leadership, especially by employing people according to their political affiliation or to their families. In the south of Iraq, most of the leadership is led by parties or by families. So the police and the military respond so aggressively against the people, and this is because of the corruption. Responding to Muqtada al-Sadr's request for an explanation of the violence at the demonstration, the Iraqi government is conducting an investigation.
With Salam Talib, this is Eliana Kaya reporting for Free Speech Radio News. Comandanta Ramona, a tiny Tzotzil indigenous woman who strategized the takeover of San Cristobal de las Casas Chiapas during the January 1, 1994 armed uprising, died in the early morning hours of January the 6th. Ramona was driven from her highlands home to San Cristobal de las Casas clinic, where the Zapatista leader's frail body succumbed to an infectious tuberculosis and kidney failure. Luz Ruiz and Tim Russo report from Chiapas.
Late on Friday, January 6, in the midst of a meeting for the Zapatistas' other campaign in Tonalá, Subcomandante Marcos Stutter pulled back and unexpectedly announced the death of 47-year-old Comandanta Ramona. He spoke only a moment, saying, The world has lost an exemplary woman. The world and Mexico has lost one of those fighters that it needs. A piece of our heart has been ripped out. Comandante Ramona was a founding member of the Zapatista National Liberation Army and a civilian commander that led the taking of San Cristóbal de las Casas on January 1, 1994. Although she had virtually no formal education, she pushed for and was instrumental in formulating the Zapatistas' Revolutionary Women's Law and has been inspirational to the struggle for equal rights for women throughout Mexico. A traditional weaver by trade, she broke the government's military circle when she went to Mexico City to speak in front of nearly 100,000 people on October 12, 1996, Dia de la Raza, demanding that then-President Zedillo respect the partial peace accords. The last time Ramona spoke publicly was during the September 17, 2005 rebel plenary session in La Garrucha to organize the other campaign.
Muy buenas noches, compañeras, compañeros. Es mi nombre, el comandante Ramona.
Good evening, compañeras and compañeros. My name is Comandante Ramona. I am very pleased that all of you have come here and that there are many of you. We want to send our greetings to you so that you will put all your energy into this work and so that we can begin to work together. Those are my words. Gracias.
Amidst flowers, prayers, and songs, Ramona's funeral was a very private event. Hundreds of Zapatista support bases paid respects to the comandante's family. Among those present was a diverse contingent of indigenous men and women, activists, and longtime supporters of the Zapatista movement. Comandante Ramona, you live in every woman that struggles, was one of the many messages inscribed in the floral arrangements that were placed on her grave in San Andrés Larrainsar. Her resting place, surrounded by colorful flowers, was marked by a simple wooden black cross that family members inscribed with her real name, Maria Díaz Santis, that January 6, 2006. Afterwards, in the fresh cement that covered the grave, they inscribed her nom de guerre, Comandante Ramona. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Luz Ruiz and Tim Russo in San Cristóbal de las Casas, Chiapas.
Over 300 local Hong Kong activists marched with 11 Korean farmers on Sunday to the Hong Kong police headquarters demanding that charges against the farmers be dropped immediately. The 11 Korean farmers were arrested and charged with unlawful assembly during protests at last month's World Trade Organization ministerial conference. The farmers, who were also arrested with three other WTO protesters, are on their sixth day of hunger strike and say they will continue indefinitely. In solidarity, a group calling itself the International Campaign for the Immediate Release of WTO Political Prisoners is calling for international solidarity to support them. FSRN's Mai Kim reports.
Yang Kyung-kyu, Vice President of the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, was one of the 14 protesters charged with unlawful assembly after clashing with the police during the World Trade Organization meetings last month. He is out on bail after being detained for 6 days.
3명이 넘는 인원을 연행했지만 저희 이 경찰이
The police arrested over 1,000 protesters. Within 48 hours, they had to find people who committed the violence. But it was impossible for them to recognize 1,000 people by checking videos or photos. And actually, 1,000 protesters did not commit tremendous violence. So I think it must have been hard for the police to choose them. Before they used videos and photos, they selected 13 people at random, and they chose me because I was a leader of the anti-WTO protests.
Of the 14 awaiting trial, 11 are Korean, one is Taiwanese, one is Japanese, and one is from mainland China. While awaiting trial, 12 of the protesters launched a hunger strike at a dock of Hong Kong 6 days ago.
경찰의 무리한 기소에 의해서 부당하게 대우받고 있고
We've been treated unfairly due to the unreasonable prosecution by the police and our legal struggle has been distorted. So 12 of us started a hunger strike to show that our struggle is justifiable and that anti-WTO protests should continue.
Jin Suk Lee is with the KCTU. She says the 14 protesters' human rights have been violated.
They're released on bail, but they have no contacts with their families. They can't work. You know, a lot of them are the sole breadwinners. They're farmers. They can't go back and support their families because they're detained in Hong Kong. They can't leave Hong Kong.
Elizabeth Tang is with the Hong Kong People's Alliance on WTO. She says that the charge should be dropped immediately and that they should be sent back to their families.
Until now, the police in Hong Kong have not been able to find any concrete evidence to show that they have committed violence. So we believe this charge is a political one, and therefore the charge should be dropped.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Mia Kim.
The recent police shooting in Columbus, Ohio, of a Somali youth who suffered mental health problems has sent waves of shock and resentment throughout the black and African communities there.
We just reversed.
And has provoked demands for an examination of police use of force policies. Evan Davis files this report.
Hey there.
An estimated 600 to 800 Somali residents held a peaceful rally on December 30th in front of Columbus's City Hall to denounce the shooting of Nasir Abdi, a Somali man with a history of mental illness who was fatally shot by Franklin County Sheriff's deputies during an altercation 2 days earlier. The officers involved reported that Mr. Abdi threatened them with a knife, but eyewitness testimonies are conflicting as to whether or not Mr. Abdi was armed. The Sheriff's Department is currently conducting an investigation and declined to comment while that investigation is pending, but many Somalis here feel that the use of lethal force in this instance is not sufficiently justified. Abdallah Jama is a vice president of the Somali Community Association of Ohio.
This particular case needs to be investigated properly. The boy was mentally unfit. He has been here more than 6-7 years, and he speaks English fluently. And all the members of his family were there, and they all speak English. With help, this was avoidable.
The police were called initially by Mr. Abdi's own parents, who sought professional assistance in apprehending their son so that he could receive emergency mental health treatment. But the officers who responded were not trained in handling the mentally ill and were not equipped with tasers or other so-called non-lethal weapons other than aerosol mace, which the officers used, they claimed, to no avail. Somali community representative Liban Ismail helped to draft the press release that was presented at the rally.
The sheriffs knew that the subject was unstable and agitated. Their mission was to take the subject in custody and present him to a mental health facility for treatment. Instead, Nasir Abdi was brutally shot and killed by the deputies. This young man was killed when in fact he was supposed to be protected by the authorities.
Opinions as to why Mr. Abdi was shot are not limited to the question of police training. At the rally, Somalis and others speculated openly as to whether or not race may have been a factor. Adam O'Hersey spoke to reporters shortly after the official press conference in front of City Hall.
And what appalls the Somali community very much is the prevalent belief. If Abdi was of different color, or if Abdi lived in a different neighborhood, things shouldn't have happened the way they have happened. That's what scares us the most.
Columbus is home to the second largest Somali population in the U.S., over 30,000 and growing, but police relations in Somali neighborhoods are not vastly different than in other predominantly African-American parts of the city, according to Asad Shabazz, co-chair of the Ohio Coalition of Concerned Black Citizens.
To me, they're Somalians by ethnicity, but they're black folks. Already have been harassed by the police over and over and over again. So I don't care if the cop was justified, because the sheriff's office and the Columbus Police Department do not make it a priority to have a relationship with the community. In the eyes of the people, they're guilty anyway.
Shabazz emphasized the need for not only police training, but for a community policing approach in which officers develop personal relationships with the citizens in the precincts they patrol. That, he says, would be a deterrent to the use of deadly force.
What has to happen? First of all, training. Officers need to be trained. Relationship building. You do not shoot people that you like. You don't. You find every other alternative. They're putting a bullet in them.
Shabazz formerly served on the Columbus Community Relations Commission, a city-funded organization that facilitates dialogue between concerned groups of citizens and law enforcement agencies. Napoleon Bell is the current assistant executive director of the commission, which is currently establishing what he calls a community intervention team in response to the Abdi shooting.
We look toward educating the public about why the police do what they do. We have several things that we are working toward this year that will provide the community a way to interact with the police and have a better understanding about what they do.
Bell explained, however, that the commission is not empowered to make policy recommendations. Meanwhile, some both in and out of the Somali community are exploring the idea of a civilian review board, which would give citizens a degree of oversight over police policies. Adnan Mirza is the executive director of the Ohio Council on American Islamic Relations.
I mean, I think that would be a good idea, and I think that would certainly be a step forward in the, I guess, in the healing process here. If people know that there's some checks and balances in the system to safeguard them, I think that's something that should be looked into.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
Since the 1950s, Britain's policy of free cradle-to-grave health care for all its citizens has been renowned worldwide. But recently, leaked government papers have proved what public health workers have suspected for a long time, that the British government is permanently opening up the doors to private companies to take over large parts of the public health care system. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
We're seeing bed closures, closure of wards, getting rid of staff, in some cases operations being put off. Community hospitals are being closed. Around the edges, we're starting to see charges creeping in.
Dr. Jackie Davis is a consultant radiologist with Britain's Public Health Service.
I think if we continue down the road towards the market, then it will mean the fragmentation and ultimate end of the public health service in this country.
It wouldn't be so bad, say public health sector workers, if increased private sector involvement in public health was helping to resolve the massive delays in treatment and the financial crisis. But the public health service deficits are getting worse, not better. This year, there may be as much as £900 million in the red. And British patients are still enduring some of the longest waiting times for operations in Europe.
I've got a high tolerance of pain, but that pain was beyond a joke. Last Christmas, I thought to myself, I'm not going to see another Christmas. I can't put up with it. I was totally convinced I was going to kill myself. I know I would have done it because I just couldn't stand it.
April Dollery needed urgent spinal surgery. But like many other cash-strapped public hospitals in Britain have started to do, they've cut their operating backlog by refusing to operate on her because she's overweight. Unable to afford to go private in Britain, she outsourced her operation to India.
I tried to say to the surgeon in England and here in Worcester, I'm not mobile, therefore I won't lose weight. And I said that I will sign any forms he likes, saying that I won't sue him if it goes wrong. And he just said no. But the surgeon over in India said, what's the problem? He said, we'll do it. Since he did the operation, my weight has fallen off me.
Lawyer Richard Stein has represented a number of patients suing the Public Health Service who've been forced to pay for their own treatment in another country and want to be reimbursed.
The government is rationing healthcare by waiting list, and the fundamental problem is that they're not prepared to bite the bullet of telling people that they need to pay more if they want to have a good health service. But given that health is the most important thing for all of us, it must be a sign of a civilized society that we put the money in to deliver the health service that everybody needs.
Last week, Richard Stein and his client won the backing of the European Court of Justice in a landmark case. The court agreed that British patients should have the right to reimbursement if they're forced to outsource their operations to other countries because of undue delays in waiting times. It's the first case to challenge the practices of the Public Health Service under EU law.
Clearly, it shouldn't be that you have to go abroad to have basic healthcare provision. That is obviously a complete anomaly, but as a safety valve, it's obviously better than having to wait around and not have the treatment at all. The government is obsessed about privatising whatever moves. I'm just not convinced at the moment that what the government are proposing is going to do anything other than line the pockets of yet more not very impressive private sector providers, as has happened in the railways and many other areas that we're aware of in Britain.
Public health sector workers are launching a campaign against further private sector involvement in public health, and they're hoping the government will listen. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Rousseau and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor, Washington editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Padgett-Seekins and Eric Klein. In Washington, D.C., I'm Selena Masuda, sitting in for Auda Bogado.
Join Out Loud, KBOO's queer news and public affairs show, on Tuesday, January 10th at 6 p.m. as we host Humble Divas, Elizabeth Lavenue and Mark Steering, who call themselves two queer singing Sagittarians. Humble Divas will present pieces from their performance titled Civil Disunion, a one-hour musical comedy that explores the challenges and humor of our fractured political climate. Come laugh with us as we forge the foibles of gay marriage and parenting, bulldoze the blatant blunders of Bush, and dance the dichotomy of our desires on Out Loud, Tuesday, January 10th at 6 p.m.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton,
KBOO News. For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a local nonprofit is working to protect a Southwest Portland community farm. We'll talk with Portland investigative journalist Jim Redden about the ways law enforcement uses snitches to solve crimes. We'll also take a look at the lighter side of the news.
And in the human cost of the war in Iraq, as of today, 2,206 American soldiers have been killed and over 42,000 have been maimed or wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,317 civilians have been killed by the war in Iraq. And last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 9th, 2006. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. The Casper, Montana Star Tribune reports that the roundup of Oregonians accused in a series of arsons in Colorado and Oregon began last year with the cooperation of one key informant. KBOO's Lisa Loving has more.
Referred to only as, quote, cooperating witness, unquote, by federal investigators, the alleged Earth Liberation Front insider knew names and dates and was willing to wear a wire to record conversations with other members. That led to six arrests in December, with two suspects saying they were ready to cooperate and a third allegedly committing suicide in an Arizona jail. The case illustrates how federal prosecutors frequently work a cold case, one that's old, slim on physical evidence, and involves a tight-lipped group of people living on the edges of society. According to those familiar with such investigations, prosecutors typically cultivate an informant who will surreptitiously record conversations with co-conspirators and then charge who they can. Quote, the federal government makes a living off tapes and snitches, unquote, said David Lane, a Denver lawyer who practices in federal court. Quote, it's absolutely standard operating procedure, unquote. Federal prosecutors also look for defendants facing potentially long federal prison terms to begin flipping or offering cooperation in exchange for leniency. That opens the door for additional charges. Kirk Engdahl, a federal prosecutor from Oregon, told a reporter, quote, we gathered information from our confidential witness regarding Vail, unquote. A source close to the Colorado investigation said that information and the cooperation of two cell members almost certainly would move the case forward. The fires set October 19, 1998, to protest the expansion at the upscale ski resort, leveled the Two Elk Lodge and restaurant on top of Vail Mountain. The fires also raised a ski patrol, headquarters, and several lift buildings. The loss was tallied at $12 million. ELF claimed responsibility for the fires in an untraceable email communique. For 5 years, it stood as the group's most destructive act of protest, one that a cadre of investigators focused their resources in solving. Authorities said William Rogers, charged in a firebombing in Washington State, used three different names. Rogers allegedly killed himself in December while being held in an Arizona jail, using a plastic bag to suffocate himself. One witness against Chelsea Gerlach and the others is Jacob Ferguson. According to Craig Weinerman, a lawyer for the accused, Ferguson is a, quote, cooperating witness, unquote, who took part in the arsons but has not been charged. Another witness is Stanislaus Meyerhoff, a high school classmate of Gerlach's, who has been charged but not for every crime he admitted to participating in, according to court pleadings. Quote, Mr. Ferguson admits setting the fires and somehow he gets a pass, unquote, Weinerman said in court last month. Quote, we should consider the source, unquote. Supporters of accused Eugene resident Kevin Tubbs say that he's been placed on suicide watch in solitary confinement since the death of William Rogers in December. I'm Lisa Loving, KBU News.
Portland investigative journalist Jim Redden of the Portland Tribune is a specialist in the ways that law enforcement uses snitches to solve long unresolved crimes. Jim is live on the phone to talk about it. Good to talk to you, Jim. Jim, are you there?
We're experiencing some technical difficulties with the phone.
All righty, we'll have to get back to this story in a moment.
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality issued a $33,000 fine against Lur Jensen and Sons of Hood River. The fine is for hazardous waste mismanagement and water quality violations at the company's facility in Hood River. Lur Jensen makes fishing lures, home smokehouses, and related accessories. The company generates hazardous waste from electroplating and painting operations. An inspection by the DEQ and EPA in June 2005 found numerous violations of Oregon hazardous waste regulations. They include improper storage, labeling, container management, reporting, and record keeping. The company also violated their stormwater discharge permit. The company is appealing the penalty. Lur Jensen was fined for similar violations in 1989, 1997, and 2001.
Portland investigative. We now have Jim Redden back on the line. Jim, are you there?
I am here.
It's good to talk to you again, Jim.
It's good to talk to you.
So we just reported on a case of Oregon environmentalists charged with eco-terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what a snitch is and how they work?
Well, I don't have any particular knowledge about these cases. I haven't done any reporting on them or anything like that. My impression, based just solely on the news reports that I've read, is that this is a pretty typical law enforcement criminal investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really too different from what they do on maybe a drug network or a stolen goods network or something like that, a situation where a number of people have conspired to commit one or more crimes, and now one or more of those people is cooperating with the investigation.
So are these snitches usually accurate?
That's a very good question, because we don't know how many informants are actually used by the government at any one time. We know when someone is charged with a crime and when an informant is either in the documents leading up to the indictment or testifies at the trial. And I'd say that the vast majority of the time that the government indicts someone for a crime, they get a conviction.
So, but do you think that innocent people are being convicted using these snitches?
It's certainly possible that innocent people have, in fact, been convicted using snitches. There's the case in Texas. I think the informant there was a fellow named Tom Coleman, who was working for the government claimed to have infiltrated mostly the black community in a small town in Texas, and they had all bought drugs from him. And on his testimony alone, people were indicted. Some pled guilty, others were convicted, and then it came out that he was not telling the truth, and that's been a huge scandal down there. The sentences have been vacated and things like that. In that particular case, really the law enforcement officials, the jury, everybody was accepting, as I understand it, Coleman's words without any other documentation whatsoever. I don't know if that's the case here. I understand the informant were wiretapped and recorded some conversations. I don't know what other evidence the government has.
Okay. Should we be, so what's the big picture? Should we be concerned about the fairness and accuracy in these cases?
Well, we should always be concerned about fairness and accuracy in any law enforcement investigation. One reason that we have our criminal justice system set up the way that it is so that innocent people don't go to jail. I mean, that's one reason why you have to get court orders to do wiretaps and search warrants. That's why you have to present your evidence to a grand jury. That's why defendants have defense attorneys appointed for them if they can't afford it. That's why they have the right to confront their accuser in a court of law. And we want to be concerned in every one of those cases that all of those checks and balances are in place. I don't know anything about these particular cases that makes me any more or less nervous than any other case. I understand that there are a lot of your listeners that have sympathy with the stated goals of the people that committed these crimes, and a lot of folks that I have talked to personally don't think that these are actual criminal offenses. They think there's some kind of higher law that applies there because these are being committed in the name of the environment. But certainly in my experience as a reporter, you know, those are not considerations that law enforcement is going to take into account.
All right. Thanks. That was Jim Redden, a local investigative reporter and author of the book Snitch Culture. Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. hear Labor Radio. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather, rain, possibly heavy at time, lows in the middle 40s. Tomorrow, more rain with highs in the lower 50s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River. A local nonprofit is working to protect Southwest Portland Community Farm. KBOO's Aaron Ernst reports.
The Tryon Life Community Farm lies nestled in a small valley just off Boones Ferry Road and surrounded on three sides by Tryon Creek State Park.
We have four areas of education: native habitat restoration, natural building, permaculture and agriculture, and also community development.
Jen Lease is one of 16 tenants who lives on the farm and volunteers for the TLC Farm nonprofit, an organization formed to protect the farm from development and to educate the public about sustainable living while building community.
The deeper layers of what we're doing here is building another place for Portland to cross-pollinate. And this is a place that's really inspiring. And when you're somewhere this beautiful and this connected to nature and community, it's really easy to be a visionary.
The farm is dotted with structures created by volunteers: a Cobb sauna, an outdoor kitchen for making Saturday pizzas, Cobb benches, and a Native American sweat lodge. Everyone chips in to make the farm work, even the farm chickens.
A chicken tractor is kind of like a movable cage where we put three or four chickens in at a time, and they prepare a bed for us. So they eat up all of the weeds and little grubs. They stir up the soil just a little bit and fertilize. So they're happy, we're happy, the garden bed is happy.
In October of 2004, the unique vision of the farm was threatened when its tenants were served an eviction notice. The landowners wanted to sell the farm to Brownstone Homes, a developer that planned to build 23 luxury houses on the site.
This is October 8th. My daughter was a week old, so I remember the date quite well.
Brenna Bell is president of the board of directors of the nonprofit TLC Farms and one of the farm's most effective advocates.
It was a very, very difficult decision, but the tenants decided not to leave because if we left, it would assure that the developer would move forward.
In court, the tenants ultimately lost, but they gained enough time to negotiate with the developer and were able to convince him to sell his option to purchase the farm.
And since that time, we were able to settle the issues around the eviction. Basically agreed that if the nonprofit exercised the option to purchase the land, the tenants could stay. If the nonprofit failed to exercise the option, the tenants had to leave.
TLC Farms was given until January 10th, tomorrow, to raise $1.4 million to buy the land outright. The donations have been pouring in, and with under 24 hours left, the farm is just $20,000 short of its goal.
Day after day, people surprise me and delight me with how they're supporting the community. And that goes for our government, too. When we sat in City Council and listened to all five commissioners commend the farm and talk about why this is the type of civic involvement and engagement that really makes Portland, Portland, it was hard for me to almost keep from crying.
Portland City Council voted to contribute $200,000 for a conservation easement, and Metro and the Friends of Tryon Creek State Park contributed another $100,000 each. Commissioner Dan Saltzman has visited the park and was struck by its vision.
You know, I think it has important natural attributes because of its proximity to Tryon Creek and Tryon Creek Park. But I also think they've become a very good laboratory of sustainability and farm life, which is very hard to come by these days inside the urban growth boundary.
The Portland community at large has been generous as well. As I was visiting the park, four longtime residents who lived near the farm drove up and personally delivered three checks, each written out for $500.
We want us to keep it and preserve it for the rest of time.
Mm-hmm. And my children also came down here and played.
Every one of us have been here somewhere around 50 years up here on Stevenson. This is one of the incredible locations in America. This is just like other major parks throughout the nation.
Those interested in helping the farm to meet its goal can learn more by visiting the farm's website at tryonfarm.org. If the farm meets its goal, the land will be purchased and transferred to the Oregon Sustainable Agricultural Land Trust to be protected in perpetuity. The Portland community will benefit, and so will the farm's tenants. Katie Rose O'Day is a tenant in charge of tending the farm's five goats.
This is my family. So yes, I love my role here, and I love the people here, and I love the spirit, and there just isn't anything about it that I don't love.
Tryon life, it fits like a glove, and feel what it's like to be free. Give thanks to the land and the sky up above, and pour your energy into building a community.
Reporting for KBOO, this is Aaron Ernst.
People interested in learning more or helping out could find out information on their website at tryonfarm.org.
An activist with the Portland Anti-Military Recruiting Coalition was arrested last week. The group demonstrates weekly outside the U.S. Army recruiting station on Northeast Broadway Avenue. Live on the phone to talk about their work is Abram Demunas, of the Portland Anti-Military Coalition. Thanks for being with us. Tell us about the Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition. What do you do?
Well, basically, we reach out to the students and parents and advising them of many elements, the undermining of the No Child Left Behind Act and how it portrays in ways of getting students private information and even their families of parents' financial situations and whatnot. And so from there we just reach out to them, acknowledge them about all those differences and try and organize within the schools and the students to be advised of military and their abuses of misleading the students and the youth into joining the military, and just basically that's basically our forefront of just making sure that students are aware of what's going on and how military misuses their authority, even from the school district. Then,
all right, talk about your regular meetings and demonstrations. What kind of people come? Have you ever had problems with police officers before?
As to my knowledge, no. This is the first that I've been hearing about these confrontations with the police and arrests. Unfortunately, I don't know much about that. As far as our meetings here in Portland, we're fortunate enough to having great community leaders and concerned parents that are willing to be involved, and they're pretty much our backbone. We just talk about what's going on, different events, and schools that may be willing to work with us and just having this awareness within Portland and just trying to bring it out to even more rural areas of Oregon.
Typically, what goes on at a demonstration when you're standing in front of one of the recruiting stations?
In one of the recruiting stations? Well, I haven't gone to one of the recruiting. I went personally to a recruiting and went in portraying that I was going to join the military. And it was pretty foul. Just, you know, he was telling me that I'd probably never see combat, this and that. And I asked him, how was he sure? I asked him, you know, different questions as far as, like, me being of a Latin heritage and immigrants abroad, if, you know, they're giving visas and this and that. And some say no, some say yes. So it's just a wide range of lies that they're giving out to individuals, you know, and we're working on exposing that.
All right. And finally, just in short, what can listeners do who wish to support your organization?
Well, get involved. That's the best thing you can do. Getting involved is probably the only thing that you can really do, because listening and all that and honking, it's a nice gesture, but it's not going to get anything done.
All right, thank you, Abram.
We have our website is
Abram. We're going to have to end that right here. Abram, thank you very much. We're going to have to go now. That was Abram Demunis of the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition. You can reach them at PAMRcoalition.org. And now, let's take a trip to the lighter side of the news with KBOO's Noah Eaton.
This is your lucky day. You have the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to pay amazingly high prices for some incredibly worthless stuff. Just keep listening, and we'll tell you over and over and over and over and over and over and over.
Aren't you glad this is KBOO? KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 92.7 in the Gorge, 100.7 in Corvallis. Non-commercial.
That was a vague approximation of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 9th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a call at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on transitor K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 on transitor K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer and audio editor for tonight's newscast was Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Noah Eaton, Aaron Ernst, and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. At 9 on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews Amy Bender, author of Willful Creatures, a collection of surrealist short stories. At 9:30, hear Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies speaking on dual occupations, Iraq and Palestine in Bush's Empire, a lecture she gave in Portland in October. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, topics are The Seagull by Artists Repertory Theater and Charlotte's Web by the Oregon Children's Theater. And at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 9th of January, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Legislation introduced last summer by the chairman and vice chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee is the topic of discussion today in Bismarck, North Dakota. Native American leaders are meeting with representatives of Senators Byron Dorgan and John McCain to discuss the legislation, which would facilitate settlement of the Cobell versus Norton class action lawsuit. The lawsuit asks the government to account for billions of dollars owed to individual Indian account holders, dating back to 1887, from royalties on oil, gas, mining, and grazing activities on Native-owned land. Tribal leaders are divided over whether to support the legislation when there is still a discrepancy over Indian trust account records and how much money is actually owed. Tex Hall, chairman of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, says it could take years to get a full accounting, and many people need the money now.
For the older people, you know, it might be to finish paying for a house. It might be to get a new car or pay for medical bills. There's a lot of poverty in an Indian country.
Hall says 40% of all the accounts in question are in the Dakotas.
We have large land-based reservations. We have a lot at stake. And so the leadership of our tribes need to step forward and say, this is what we think is something we can live with.
The Cobell lawsuit was filed in 1996 by Blackfeet banker Eloise Cobell on behalf of more than 500,000 individual Indian account holders. The meeting today takes place at the United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. In other news, on the Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota, Chief Sitting Bull's grave is perched on a bluff overlooking the Missouri River. The site had been neglected for many years and land around it used as a trash dump. But that began to change last spring when two men purchased the property. The new owners want to see it protected and preserved. The restoration process is now underway, as well as a plan to develop the site for visitors. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Julia Munzunski has the story.
Since purchasing the property, Rhett Elbers says he and Brian Defender, a Standing Rock Sioux tribal member, have created a website and a nonprofit organization called the Sitting Bull Monument Foundation. He says they've also cleared trash and debris from the 40-acre area and established some security for the site. Elbers says their goal is to build a cultural center there to honor the Lakota Hunkpapa leader. He says he's excited that they've found architect Dennis Sunrhodes, who's interested in taking on the project.
And he's an Indian architect that has a great deal of experience in Native American projects. And so we're just thrilled to have him on board, and he has made a trip to the site. We've been able to meet there and visit about the possibilities.
Elbers says currently he and Defender are pursuing grants and other fundraising sources so they can proceed with development plans. Julia Munzunski, Rapid City, South Dakota.
In a whole new realm of cooperation, 18 California tribes have worked together to build what's being called a tribal digital village. Ellen Churchak reports from Sacramento.
The Tribal Digital Village is an internet system that connects all 18 tribes in San Diego County so they can work together on various projects. The county has the largest number of tribes of any in the United States. The Digital Village aids them in communication. Frank Ross, Associate Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of California, San Diego, helped the tribes develop the village.
This project was created to connect the 18 tribes through internet to each other to promote economic development, educational advancement, cultural preservation and training of youth, and to bring tribal government and tribal life into 21st century.
Ross says the digital village could make a difference in the upcoming 2006 California governor's election because it will allow the tribes to work together on political strategies if they want. I'm Ellen Churchak in Sacramento.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, engineers and scientists concerned with the earth, RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a multi-regional, multi-tribal federal corporation serving Indian country. Amerind-Corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.